And I'm not quite sure how this happens, but I know that it does happen because it happens to me a lot. Just not too long ago, I think it was a Friday night, and for some reason, we didn't have a full calendar. We didn't have to go see anybody. Nobody was coming to see us. We weren't babysitting. We weren't going to the kids' house for dinner. We just had an evening, a Friday evening, with nothing on the calendar, which is pretty rare. And I was caught up on my reading, and I said, let's just watch a movie. And so I, you know, flipped on the satellite and looked at all 337 channels. And, of course, there's not a thing on worth watching. And so I said, I'll go down to this market, and I'll look around. It's been a while since I rented a DVD. Let's see what they got. So I went down there and went in the back room, and I'm looking through the movies. And I don't really, not looking for anything in particular. I'm just looking. And so I'm kind of cruising around, and I see one, the picture, I don't know, gets my attention. It's an actor that I recognize, and I kind of, you know, pull the box down and turn it over and look, and the first words I read are, you know, from deep in the heart of evil, and I kind of threw it back on the shelf. I said, no, I don't need any of that, you know. Actually, I think it flew back on the shelf, but so I kept looking, and I kept looking, and I finally found something, no big deal. It was, you know, I don't know, Willy Wonka or something, you know, family-friendly kind of thing. I'm so sick of poisoning myself with what I really like, which we'll talk more about in a minute. And so I got my movie, and I'm headed for the counter, and I heard this. So what's that? There's something else, because, I mean, I've only been here for 4 years, but it seems like, you know, I know all the gals and Greg and all the gals that work at the store, and a lot of you run into folks up at the store, and psst, psst, and I hear it down. And so I'm kind of going down past the vegetables down the back aisle, and I swear somebody said, Ron, what the heck? And I went back there, and I turned the corner, and it was the Peanuts. And you know what I'm talking about, bottom shelf, about three rows in from the lettuce, you know? You know where they are, come on. And there they were, and there was a bag of peanuts just smiling up at me, like, take me home, Daddy, you know. And so I did. I grabbed it, and I went up the counter, and I paid for my stuff, and I got home, and I put the bag on the table. Now, Mary knows that movies don't come in big paper bags. So she's looking, and she goes, and she reaches in, she goes, how did these get in here? I said, I don't know. I didn't go to the store. I wasn't hungry. I think we just had dinner. I wasn't hungry, and I didn't need anything. I didn't really want anything. I didn't think of it on the drive down there. I wasn't trying to sneak anything by, you know, none of that stuff. It's just I was getting a movie and just walking. I wasn't even in the peanut aisle, you know. I mean, it wasn't even like I saw them and went, oh, I know what I'll do. It's just something, you know, kind of grabbed me and pulled me in, and it turns out that it was those peanuts. Now, you know, how does that work? How does that happen, and why does it happen so often? Last week, we talked about trials in the first 12 verses of James 1, and we talked about how the Lord uses these tests or trials to prove our faith. Not to prove it to him, but to prove it to ourselves. To prove that we can pass the test. And not just for that one time, but for all time. Remember, we talked about an assayer, and you take that sample to the assayer, and they'll say, oh, that's pure gold. Well, that means you've got a whole gold mine. In the same way, when our test, our faith is put to the test, and it's proven true, that doesn't mean that we just make it through that one test or trial. That means that our faith is genuine and real and strong to pass, you know, the next test and the next test. That's trials. This morning, we're going to learn about, you know, a test's, you know, second cousin, I guess you could put it, temptation. And we'll talk about the difference between the two in just a minute. But as we learn about temptation here, we're going to learn where it comes from, what its purpose is and how we can short circuit that process. You know, you may walk through the store and peanuts are the last thing on your mind. But then somehow, some way, they become the main thing on your mind. There's a part of you that gives up and gives in without even much of a fight. But the good news is that doesn't have to be the case. So let's look into this thing called temptation. We're going to start reading in verse 13 of James chapter 1. Let no one say when he's tempted, I'm tempted by God. For God can't be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then, when desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. Don't be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Now these next several lessons that we're going to see, that we're going to study through in the book of James, all kind of have an overall title, which, as you can see on the screen, is Faith That Works. That's basically the theme of James, faith that works, what it is, what it looks like, how it works, and how we make it work for us. So for today, let's just say that for faith to work when you're tempted, the first thing you need to do is recognize the source. Let no one say when he's tempted, I'm tempted by God. For God can't be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. Now notice, first of all, that just as with trials, you will be tempted. It says in verse 13, let no one say when he is tempted, not if he is tempted. You can count on temptations coming your way. Now, we talked about trials last week, and trials and temptations can present themselves in similar ways. The difference is in their purpose. As you'll remember from last week, the purpose of a trial is to encourage faith, to prove that I can pass the test, that, you know, God really is at work in my life. And my faith is proven. The purpose of a temptation, on the other hand, is to entice you to failure. Whereas a test is intended to build you up, a temptation, by its nature, is intended to bring you down. That's the difference. It's kind of like with that drive test I talked about last week when my son took his driving test. You know, you pass the test, and then you're good to go. You can drive almost forever, unless you get too old, like that joke I read. You know, but you don't take the test next month or next year or even in 10 years. You can just drive, you know, because you already passed the test once. And the difference is like passing your driving test as opposed to driving by the Häagen-Dazs store. You know, the Häagen-Dazs store just kind of pulls your car. Or maybe it's the scrapbook store. I'm not looking at anybody in particular. Or maybe it's the sporting goods store, the fishing poles and the rifles and the camouflage gear. I've just fallen in love with Bob's. I'd never been there till about a month or two ago, and now I'm a regular. I just go through there to make myself feel better. Just to walk through the boots and the stuff, you know, and the gear and the t- tense. I like that, you know. And so that's the difference. If, you know, the passing the test allows me to drive and I'm good to go, but temptation always wants to pull you in. But we have to remember that, well, that's the first thing you have to remember, that they will, it's going to happen. There's no if about it. It's a will. You will be tempted. But verse 13 tells us pretty clearly, you'll never be tempted by God. You know, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm tempted by God. For God can't be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. You know, God is the source of good. God is all and only good. Goodness doesn't just describe God, but God defines goodness. Remember in Matthew 19, the rich young ruler passage, probably familiar to most of us. And he came and he said, you know, now behold, one came to Jesus and said to him, good teacher, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life? And Jesus said to him, why do you call me good? There's no one good but God. Right down in verse 17 here in James, it says, every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. God's the source of good. He's not the source of evil and temptation. Verse 18 tells us pretty clearly that God is the giver of life. You know, of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth. Now, I think it was my father that said, I brought you into this world and I'll take you out. But that was my father, and I don't blame him. That's not our heavenly father. You know, God is the giver of good things. He's the giver of life. He's not one that brings temptation and failure into our lives. Sin leads to death. I think that's a pretty basic fact, a basic understanding of our faith. Sin brings death, but Jesus, as we know, gives life. Romans, the wages of sin, you know, what you earn or what you've got coming to you because of sin is death. But the wages of faith, on the other hand, is life in Christ Jesus. Now, it's good to know that. God is not the source of temptation ever. God is all and only good always. And he doesn't change. That's what this business in the second part of verse 17 is about. Every good gift and perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights. That's an interesting term. With whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. The Father of lights. Now, there are different takes on what exactly that means. It's kind of it's a lofty concept. God is the Father of lights. But, I mean, literally, what the heck is it talking about? And it's true. God is he's the creator of the sun, all the suns, the moon, the stars, you know, lights in that sense. He is he designed into his creation here on earth the principles of electromagnetism that were developed and discovered and ultimately resulted in these light bulbs that you don't really realize how much you count on them till the power goes out. You ever have the power go out and the first thing you do is go look for a flashlight and flip the switch trying to find the flashlight? And you go, oh, that's right. Well, you can thank God for that, whether it's the daylight and the sun or the moonlight or the electric light. I mean, light, you know, the Bible says God is light. So he's literally that kind of light. But here he's called the Father of lights, in whom or with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. You know, great is thy faithfulness, O God our Father. There is no shadow of turning with thee. He's the same, right? Yesterday, today, and forever. God doesn't change. The picture here is like a sundial. You know how that works. Maybe you built one in Cub Scouts or Campfire Girls or something. Maybe you just drew a circle and put up a stick, and then you watch all through the day as that shadow moves around as the sun moves, right? And his point is here, the sun might move, the shadows might move, but with God, there's no turning. There's no shadow. There's no changing. God isn't going to suddenly look at you and say, you know what? I've never tempted anybody yet, but this one, it's not going to happen. It's not in his nature. God can't do evil. That's one of those conundrums you get into when you contemplate the nature, the very nature of God. It's like that question, can God make a rock so big that he can't lift it? Well, let's see, he's God. He can lift anything, but then if he's God, he can also make a rock so big, but then he can, and you kind of get, your brain just gets tied in a knot even trying to think about it. It's kind of a silly question. But, you know, can God do evil? Would God bring evil into someone's life? No. But could he? You know, like, could he build that rock? Well, he's God. He can do anything. But I guess the real question is, would he? Well, no, he wouldn't. And in that sense, he can't, because God's nature is all and always and only good. Then he can't violate that nature by doing anything even remotely connected with evil. Now, that's important for us to get a handle on. It's, I think we touched on this last week. I don't know, was it the insurance companies that invented the phrase, it's an act of God? Imagine the worst thing that could happen, and then they call it, it was an act of God. Well, no, it wasn't. God doesn't bring tragedies, death, disease, earthquakes, tidal waves, all that stuff. He doesn't bring that stuff. You can't blame it on him. You can blame it on, you know, great-great-grandma and grandpa Adam and Eve, because they're the ones that opened the door for sin to come into this world. And I know that when the Bible says even all creation groans waiting for the day to be delivered from sin, I think, you know, the volcano 26 years ago was part of that groaning. And the tsunami that went through the Middle East a year or two ago was part of that groaning. Every time in California when there's a little rumble, that's the earth groaning to be delivered from this burden of sin. And you can't blame that on God. God is always and only good. He doesn't tempt anyone. He never has, and he never will. You will never be enticed to fail by God. Now, you will sometimes be tempted by the enemy. Look again at verse 13 when it says, let no one, when he's tempted, say, I'm tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil. Now, here James is associating temptation with evil. That's his rationale. It can't be from God because God is good. But there is a connection between temptation sometimes and the enemy. That's what this verse does. It associates that. Now, when Jesus was in the desert for 40 days, it clearly says he was tempted. All the gospels that tell that story use the word tempted. He went into the desert to be tempted. Matthew and Luke both say specifically he was tempted by the devil. It's the word diablos. It literally means the accuser, you know, the one who brings the accusation. That's why I love Colossians 1:20 so much, that if we hold fast to the faith to which we were delivered, the Lord finds us holy and blameless and beyond accusation. You know, the enemy can point fingers all day long and tattletale all day long. And he can even, if I don't know if he's capable, but if he were, he could even tell the truth. Lord, do you know what they were thinking at that? Yeah, the Lord knows. But he says, you know what? There's no accusation. Why? Because of Jesus. Because he went to the cross in our place. He says here, it's evil, and there's a connection with the devil. Now, in Mark's gospel, it even more specifically says that Jesus, when he went into the desert, was tempted by Satan. He names names, your proper name, Satan, Satanas in Greek, which literally means the adversary, right? Our adversary, the devil, roams about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Who do lions go after? The leader of the herd? No. The newborn calf. The injured one. The sick one. The straggler. The weak one. That's who the devil goes after. And that's where temptation comes. You know, we can never say, the devil made me do it. And the reason we can say that is because the devil can't make you do anything. He can entice you. He can somehow make, he can bring temptation into your life and make sin look attractive, but he can't make that decision for you. But sometimes, your temptation never comes from the Lord. Sometimes it comes from the enemy. You will most often be tempted, though, by your own desires. Bottom line. I don't know what the percentage is. I wouldn't take a guess. 99 out of 100, something like that. But it's just our own desires. Remember, we'll never be tempted by God. You'll sometimes be tempted by the enemy, as Jesus was. But most often, we're tempted by our own desires. And because of that, for faith to work when you're tempted, you not only need to recognize the source, but you also need to recognize the process to be drawn away by our own desires. Now, this is described two different ways here in James, this process of being tempted by our own desires. The first one is a picture that I think, that all the fishermen among us should recognize and understand pretty clearly, because he uses fishing language here in verse 14. But each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Now, that doesn't sound like fisherman language, but if we dig into it a little bit, you'll see that it will. This word drawn away, maybe it can be translated drawn out. Now, I have to say, those of you that are NIV positive, I love the NIV. A lot of times it just is spot on, but this is a spot where the NIV does you a great disservice because it uses the word dragged away. And that's just not the concept that the text is describing. You're not dragged, kicking and screaming by the hair anywhere. You're drawn away, you're drawn out. It's the idea of, the way a fish will find the calm water and down behind a log or behind a big rock to get out of the current and just kind of rest there for a while. That's the idea that you're hiding there, right, behind that rock, but then something happens to draw you out from behind the rock, to draw you out in the open, to draw you out where you're vulnerable. It's like fishing with a flashlight and a net, That's not really fair, but that's the idea. You come and somebody hits that flashlight and the fish is just drawn. And when he's out there in the open, then you can just reach down there with a net and scoop him up. So that's part of the fishing language, part of that danger. I like the picture, though. It kind of ties in with that great song because, who is our hiding place? You are my hiding place. You always fill my heart with songs of deliverance. The Lord is our hiding place. Who's our rock? The Lord is our rock. And so the enemy is going to try to draw us away from the safety of the rock, out of our hiding place in the Lord. He's going to attract our attention and persuade us, if he can, to approach that forbidden thing, whatever that thing might be. Each one is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Now, you can't get much more fishing specific than this, because the word enticed is lured. And everybody that fishes uses a lure of some sort. Whether it's live bait or a purple plastic worm or a number 23 shiny, Baba Gun, some crazy name they make up for that stuff. Well, if I just had my purple spittoon on me, we'd be pulling them out of here. That's the idea, being lured out. There's a process when the deep sea fishermen, especially when they're fishing for shark, and if you watch any Jacques Cousteau or National Geographic, you see this. They grind up this disgusting mix of fish guts and blood and stuff, and they call it chum. And they have buckets of it. And they just go out in the ocean and they pick a spot that they think is good, and they start pouring this chum in the water, just dumping it overboard. Buckets and buckets of it. Well, the sharks can be miles away, and suddenly they're going, You smell that? And boom, here they come. They're drawn out, right? They're drawn out. But then once they get there, then there's, you know, a fish on a hook or you know, a diver. Shark's favorite bait. Guy in a wetsuit. But that's the idea. It's that chum that draws them out. And then there's a lure, you know, the bait that they're, you know, enticed, lured to bite. And you take the bait, you strike at the bait. Now, the bait in this case, he says, that the enemy uses are our own desires. See, it's not the Lord that tempts us. It's not, it can be, but it's not usually even the enemy that tempts us. It's our own desires. The old King James uses the word lusts. Now, we have come to only think of the word lust in a sexual, physical context, but it's a much broader word than that. And what it really refers to are just those natural desires of the flesh. All of them, whatever they might be. And let's remember, these physical desires aren't bad in and of themselves, but they have great potential for abuse. And they have great potential to take control. And that's what they do if we let them. I remember just last week talking with the guys and gals up at the rehab at our Bible study we do on Tuesday nights. And it sort of came up. We're going through Philippians up there. And it just sort of came out of the study that, you know, of all the choices that we have about anything, anytime, you know what's of the enemy, because when you make a choice that the enemy tempts you toward, the ultimate result is you lose your freedom. Whereas when it's a choice, a godly choice, you always have the freedom to change your mind. Even the best choices we make in godly things, God, we never get to that point where we are unable to choose otherwise. I wish it was the other way around. I really do. I wish I could just walk by the peanuts and never have to worry about it, but just go into total withdrawal if I don't read my Bible in the morning. You know? But it's the opposite, you know? I mean, and not to pick on anybody's, any particular stuff, but I mean, pick your habit. Pick your vice, whatever it might be. I'm not even going to name one. Just you fill in the blank and you think it through. If it's not of the Lord, is it something that just a demand of the flesh, a desire of the flesh, and if it feels good, do it, so you do it, and yeah, it does feel good, and after X amount of time, you can't say no, can you? I mean, you literally do not have the ability to say no. And if you're really tough, and if you're really, you know, just stubborn about it, then maybe a few of us can break the grip that that stuff has on us. But that's usually not the case. That's by far the exception, not the rule. Whereas the things of God, you know, you pray every morning for 25 years, you start your day with a prayer, and then it's still tomorrow morning, it's Lord, you know, help me follow you. You'd think the habit would be established, you know? And maybe it is. You go, you grab your copy, you sit in your same chair, you open that same Bible. But, you know, it's like in any given day, we just have the natural ability to stop. But that's not the way it is with the things of the enemy. That's how this fishing thing works. Once you take the bait, you know, the desires themselves aren't bad unless we allow them to control us. That's why Paul says in Romans, you know, all things are lawful for me, but I won't be mastered. He just refused to enter into those things that he knew would take away his control. You say, we want to say, but I can't help it. I couldn't help myself. Well, I certainly understand that. I mean, been there, done that, am there, do that. But we can't honestly say that. That's not a true statement, because yes, I can help it. Yes, we all can help it. Remember, part of the fruit of the Spirit is self-control. Now, remember, be careful. It's not fruits, plural, of the Spirit with all that little itemized list. Those are all one fruit. And that fruit is just a description of the character of Christ as Christ comes to live inside of you and we get ourselves out of the way and let him live his life through us. It's his love, his joy, his peace, his self-control and patience and all the rest. That's what that fruit's about. See, one of the consequences, to use that word in a positive sense, of surrendering your life to Jesus living inside of you, which is what he promises to do, is that those choices that appealed to the flesh don't appeal to him. You ever notice how easy it is to say no to something you don't like? Liver and onions? Pass. You know, how about if I sock you in the nose? That's all right. Find somebody else. We don't have a problem saying no to that stuff that we don't like. And see, what the Lord does is he comes in. It's Romans 12:2. Don't be conformed, shaped and molded by the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And that word transformed is metamorphosed, like a caterpillar to a butterfly. He's talking about not just a change in appearance, but a change in our essential nature. And even more than a change in my nature, what it really is his nature. You know, I must decrease, he must increase. Paul says, put off the old man and put on the new man. Old things have passed away, new things have come. And as I strive to surrender, that's my new favorite little word that just popped up the other day. But as I strive to surrender, it gets easier to say yes to the things that I want to say yes to and easier to say no to the things that I wanted to say no to all along. I remember being a drug addict and just looking at that pile of powder thinking, and honestly meaning, I hate this stuff. Quick, give me some. You know, it's not a question of I really want to, but I just can't. You get to the point where you hate it, and you just can't say no. Here's the good news, and I think we talked about this. 1 Corinthians 10:13 tells us that no temptation, right, no enticement, no lure, no bait has been dangled, except such as is common to man, so we're all in this together. But God is faithful, who won't allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. That's why I can say, or that's why I can't say, I can't help it. Because God promises right here that with his strength, with his help, with his power, yes, I absolutely can help it. But with the temptation, he will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Now, every fisherman understands that to catch a fish, you have to use the right kind of bait. Right? Simple. Whether you use a piece of corn or a worm or a plastic purple worm, depends on what kind of fish you're fishing for and what water. Is it a lake? Is it a stream? Is it a, you know, whatever. All of that changes. Well, Romans 12:2 tells us that as we surrender to the Lord, the result of that metamorphosis from the inside out is that that old bait doesn't appeal anymore. It works just like a fisherman. That's the first picture he paints. The next picture he paints is this temptation, this process of temptation is just like childbirth. And you don't have to be a mother to get this, but you certainly have a special angle on it, you know. You don't have to be a father either, although that even gives you a better kind of grip on reality. 15, it says, then when desire, right, the lusts of the flesh, my cravings for the things that I think are going to satisfy me when in reality all they do is enslave me. When the desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, you know, about this, my beloved brethren. So, first he talks about conception and death in this picture of childbirth. Think about it. An idea pops into your head. That's the conception. Maybe you see or hear something that triggers a craving. Just yesterday at the men's breakfast, Tim used a great illustration. He said, you know, he said every time that it's springtime and you kind of sit by the window and close your eyes and you or your neighbor have just mowed their lawn and that smell of freshly clipped grass comes into your nose and suddenly you're taken somewhere. You know, you're taken back to when you were a kid, or you're taken, you know, maybe it was a great time, maybe it was an awful time, but you're taken there, right? It's a trigger that those senses, that smell, pulls, I guess, in a sense. It triggers that craving. Or, you know, maybe you see or hear something, maybe there's no trigger at all, though. Maybe it just comes out of nowhere. Peanuts. And that's why it's so critical, you know, that's the conception. That's why it's so critical what we expose ourselves to. The triggers that we let into our lives. You know, it's pretty basic when you think about it, but we just rarely put it into practice. If your struggle is sexual in nature, then avoid the magazine aisle. Turn off the TV, because that is all you're going to see. I shared with the guys yesterday, the most pornographic thing I've seen for years is a gum commercial on TV. You know, it's buy our gum and you can start a family with our gal. That's what they're saying. You know, that's where it concludes. And if that's the struggle, then don't go there. You know, if you know you're prone to take a certain kind of bait, then don't go near the bait so you don't have to deal with it. That seems kind of simple. True story, had knew a gal in Vancouver. Still know her. haven't seen her in a long time. But that when she and her husband first got married, you know, he worked in an office and made okay money, but they weren't rich and they hadn't had any kids yet or anything. And it was one of those, you know, where we're getting by, but we're not really able to travel or buy the toys we want to have, kind of a thing. And this gal was brought up to think, you know, to put a whole lot of high value on the clothes that she wore. I don't know how that happened. When she was little, she was judged by the clothes she wore, and so she just had a real burden, you know, to look good, and nothing wrong with that. But she'd go down to the mall with a credit card and she'd look around. Oh, that would look good on me. Oh, that's my color. Well, then of course you have to have the shoes. And you know, that necklace down at the jewelry store would just look great with this outfit. And next thing you know, she spent like $1,000 or $2,000 on the credit card. And she'd bring it all home and it would be, you know, the sacks and boxes laid out on the bed. And her husband would come home and he'd say, "Honey, what's all this?" And she says, "Well, I just had to, you know, I had to have it. I just walked by, you know, and then the shoes called my name. Hey, wear me, Imelda." I used to call my daughter Imelda. She had a closet full of shoes that I paid for. Wait a minute. But, and you know, inevitably it would just like once a month or every couple of months she'd do this, and then he would have to say, you know, I mean, he's a good guy. He wouldn't freak out and blow his top, or he'd just say, "Honey, we can't afford this stuff. You're going to have to take it back." And she would kind of go, "Yeah, I know." And she'd, you know, wrap it all up and go back down to Nordstrom or wherever and say, I don't want it. It doesn't fit," or whatever she had to do to get their money back on the credit card. You know, now that's a real problem. I'm not trying to make light of the problem. It seems funny if you don't struggle with it. It seems silly, but for her it was a real issue. And they'd come to Bible study and we'd pray for them and all that stuff. And you know, but the easy thing for her to do, like step number one, don't go to the mall with the credit card. Because then you can't. Don't go down the magazine aisle. If they're just going to pull you in, don't go down the peanut aisle. If that's really a problem for you, just don't go there. He said, but it's like childbirth, the way the whole thing worked. First, this idea pops into your head, and then next thing you know, you've done it, and then there's guilt, and there's, you know, you're sorry and all that. Conception, birth, then he talks about in the same verse when, desire gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. It's like a child, you know, it eats more, consumes more of your resources, takes up more room around that. I mean, you two might have been fine in a little studio apartment, but six kids later, it doesn't work. They grow and they take up room and they eat. Man, I can't believe how much my kids used to eat, especially Corby. You know, when he was 16, he was just a vacuum. Refrigerator's empty. What do you got now, Mom? I don't know. I got to wait till payday to fill it up again. But, you know, it is like a child. It eats more, takes up more room, consumes your resources. And then when this child is fully grown, when it reaches maturity, it brings death. Not physical, put me in a box, plant me in the ground death, so much as spiritual death. I'm completely disconnected from my Creator, the one who promised to live inside of me if I would just get me out of the way and let Him. Conception, birth, growth, that's always the way this process works. You know, it's like luring a fish out from the safety of a hiding place and enticing him to take the bait. It's like this conception and growth and birth. There's just a process that's going to happen. It's just like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. I mean, let's go back to where this started, huh? Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2, verse 16. Now this is where the Lord put the only limitation on an otherwise limitless, all expense paid vacation life. And the Lord God commanded the man, Adam, saying, "Of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die." You know, Adam, you have a perfect, innocent existence. There's no such thing as right or wrong for you. It's just all good. It's all right. It's all free. There's stuff for you to do. There's all creation for you to enjoy. Go for it, man. Just one thing. Stay away from this one tree. Now, in the next chapter, at verse 6, chapter 3, 6. "So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate." Just by the way, I think we've skip over that last part too much. Eve takes all the blame. Dumbo was standing right there. Standing right there watching and didn't say a word. "Honey, can I talk with you for a minute?" Nothing. Anyway. And that's what Dumbo continues to do unless the Lord gets a hold of him and teaches him how to be a real husband. "So when the woman saw the tree was good for food..." Now we're looking for patterns here, remember? So the first part of the pattern, she saw it. She saw it with her eyes. It appealed to the senses. Now traditionally this has been represented as an apple. It doesn't say apple, doesn't say apple tree. But you know, whatever it was, and let's say it was an apple. Boy, that baby is red. And it's big and it looks juicy. And even though I've never had an apple before, I can just tell by the way that looks. She saw that it was good for food and, or that it was pleasant to the eyes, and that it was a tree desirable to make her wise. It was desirable. See, now she's past just looking at it. Now she's thinking about it. I desire, I want, you know what, I'll bet not only does that taste good, I'll bet that'll be good for me, I'll bet it'll make me wise. You know, I think this would be a good decision. I don't, you know, I know I heard something about this warning thing. This day, you know, the day you eat of it, you shall surely die thing. But I'm not going to worry about that too much right now because it looks good. And the more I think about it, the better of an idea it sounds. And then ultimately, you know, well, so far she's drawn out by the appearance. She's lured to it. It becomes bait to her as she continues to contemplate it. And ultimately she eats it. And it probably did taste good. Sin usually is good for a season. And then it killed him. And then for the first time ever, God's creation was disconnected from him. And we inherit that disconnection. Temptation has been called the opportunity to accomplish a good thing a bad way. Think about that for a minute. The opportunity to accomplish a good thing in a bad way. Need to pass an exam? Cheat. Buy the answers on the internet. Look over the guy next to your shoulder. You need something? I mean really need it? Are you starving? You need food? Are you freezing? You need some clothes? Hey, steal them. Justify it, right? It's a good thing to pass the test, to be, you know, to eat, to be clothed, but accomplished in a bad way. You need the fulfillment of a God-centered marriage, but you settle for the thrill of a one-night stand. You need permanent, eternal satisfaction, but you keep investing in temporary things. You know, you can short-circuit the process. You can short-circuit temptation completely when you recognize its source and when you learn to recognize that process. See, if it's the enemy, the word says, resist him. Resist the enemy and he'll flee. Why? Because he prefers an easy target. He doesn't want people who stand up to him. If you stand up to him, he just says, I got better things to do. There's weak and lame, you know, animals for me to pursue and devour. There's people who won't put up a fuss. I don't need to waste my energy on you. And that's exactly, you know, that idea of resisting temptation right now. I live that out. And everybody who's ever quit anything, smoking, drinking, drugs, whatever, you know, chewing your fingernails, everybody who's ever been through that process understands what I mean, because you've tried to quit, but you can't. You failed. You tried, but it didn't work out. And you try it again, but then next thing you know, you're back at it. You know, and you try and you fail and you try and you fail. Oh, finally, one day comes along and you think, this is just it. This is it for me. I'm going to call on all the resources of the Spirit of God. I'm going to pray. I'm going to trust God. I'm going to fill myself with the Spirit of God and let the fruit of the Spirit grow in me. And you're just sitting there and you're thinking, well, I'm not doing it right now. And, okay, I'm still not doing it. It's been 10 seconds. I'm still not doing it. And pretty soon a minute goes by. Yeah, still, I'm not drinking. I'm not using. I'm not reaching for it. I'm still, you know, just one, you know, the one day at a time can be broken down to one nanosecond at a time. I'm not doing it now. I'm still not doing it. Next thing you know, you're at the end of a first day. A day. I resisted the enemy and he fleed. And God did not lead me into it. Allow me to be tempted beyond what I can bear. And God was right. He held me up and the enemy. And the next day, it's still not easy. But I'm not doing it now. And I'm not doing it now. And now and now and now. And pretty much now just leads up to all the time. And you know what? I'm free. Resist the enemy and he'll move on to an easier target. Now, if it's your own desires you know, that are trying to draw you out and lure you and bait you, then just don't come out from behind the rock. You know, he is my hiding place. Hide in him. You know, and it's the same principle. You just don't take the bait. Don't look at it the way Eve did. And don't think about it, how good it might be. But, you know, I've heard that. Well, it's like saying, well, don't think about, you know, a big pink gorilla. Well, now that's all I can think about. Or I've been told, don't think about the peanuts. Well, thanks for reminding me. You know, don't think about it doesn't work. What you have to do is be actively thinking about something else. Now, that doesn't mean you lock yourself in a closet with a Bible and somehow magically, you know, that rarely, if ever, works. But short of locking yourself in a closet with the Bible, there are other ways to expose ourselves to God's truth and surround ourselves with God's people so that we can protect one another. You know, I said this once when I was doing men's ministry at Crossroads. I mean, you talk about a bunch of goofed up guys, messed up, serious problems, divorces and guys going to jail and just, you know, addictions and all the stuff that goes along with it. And I said, you know what, fellas, one of the great things about coming to this meeting, this men's meeting on Tuesday nights, is I have yet to see a guy bring his girlfriend or a bong. Because you're here. You put yourself someplace where those behaviors don't fit, and then you don't have to worry so much about it. But if you're going to go pace up and down in front of the adult bookstore, I'm not going to go in. I'm not going to go in. Hey, you've lost already. You know? Anyway, let's wrap this up. You got to remind yourself first thing every morning that by faith, Jesus lives inside me. And then you got to let him live inside you. You got to strive to surrender. See, the giver of life, he wants you to succeed. You don't have to persuade him. It's his goal for you. His desire for you is success, is to grow through the trials you go through and to resist the temptations that the enemy or the flesh bring into your life. He wants you to succeed. He gave his life to guarantee your success. Grab that guarantee. Amen.